home of Cambridge music. We are Cambridge 105.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Hello and welcome to Flavour. Thanks to Brian O'Reilly for the last 2 hours, and I am Matt Bentman.
I'm Ruth Reyes.
And I'm Alan Alder. We're live in the studio in Gwydir Street, bringing you news about Cambridge's ever-growing food and drink scene, including today, Jack Van Praagh from Jack's Gelato talking with Rosie Sykes about, well, gelato, but also about what might come next.
Pina Broccoli Anaya is back with us, this time finding out some of the culinary approaches used by the new Provenance Kitchen. Pretty impressive it is too.
And on the subject of cooking, there's a new book called The Cambridge Cookbook. It's just out. We find out more from one of its contributors, Gerla. You may know that she's been on one of the Cambridge food tours. She organises them, in fact, and we'll be talking with her about that too.
New on the market is a vegan sweet treats stall. Matt, our man with the sweet tooth, went out to find out more.
If you grow your own fruit and veg or would like to, Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments will be along with some timely tips.
And on the drinks front, I've been talking with Alice Archer of Cambridge Wine Merchants in Cherry Hinton Road about champagne.
And as usual, at the end of the programme, we'll be bringing you up-to-date Cambridge food and drink news.
But let's begin with Jack Van Praagh, the man behind one of Cambridge's biggest treats, Jack's Gelato. When Tim Hayward was in the process of taking over Fitzbillies, he said in an interview, "A couple of days later, as I'm screwing on the new tabletops, Jack walks in off the street. I'm getting used to these walk-ins now. I've had a couple of lovely old people come in and share their recollections of the place in the 1930s, a deranged-looking woman who harangued me about the colour of the tiles, and one bloke who tried to walk off with my power saw. Jack is a little different. He likes the look of the place, might be interested in doing a few shifts. Do you have much experience?" I ask. "I used to run my own place, then worked at Rose Bakery in Paris and Chez Panisse in Berkeley," comes the reply. I put down my screwdriver to shake hands. Well, that story was the first I heard of Jack, who's now such a well-known character in Cambridge. But how's he doing? What's he doing? What might he do in the future? Rosie Sykes did the sensible thing and asked him.
I'm sitting here with Jack from Jack's Gelato in his lovely spacious unit, and he's just been telling me that he's had his busiest weekend ever. So where have you been this weekend, Jack?
Been to Oundle Food Festival on Saturday during the day, which was fantastic. Just every year just keeps on getting better and better, so that was lovely. And then that finished at 4 and then packed up quick as possible and raced back to Cambridge for the Mill Road Midsummer party, which was great fun. And then simultaneous with that, there was also a wedding happening in Chippenham, and there was the flowering of Titan Arum at the Botanics. So there were all kind of simultaneous things going on at the same time.
My goodness. Did you do a special flavour for the smelly lily? That's what it is, isn't it?
It is quite smelly, yeah. No, it didn't provide inspiration, sadly.
Thank heavens, actually, I would have thought. So there are a lot of these food festivals and fairs these days, Jack. Is that a staple part of your business, would you say? Or is it street trading? Where do you see yourself?
Well, one of the things I like about my business is that it has lots of different strands. So it is an important part of the business. It's also important not just from a financial perspective, but it also just, you know, it's lovely. It was one of the things that keeps me motivated and keeps me going the most, because, you know, it's where the people are most enthusiastic about the new flavours. And where, so at Oundle, you know, I don't do anything in that part of the country apart from once a year. So, you know, each year people come back and they remind me about the flavours that we did last year and ask about what's been happening since the, so it's a nice kind of checking in point each year. And it's just kind of, you know, and then you come back and you're super kind of hyped up to bring something better the next year.
Are there any flavours that roll over, or do you always try and go with new flavours, or how does that work?
Well, that's a really interesting question, actually, because when I first started, so if we go back to Arundel, say, but this probably is the same for most events. When I first started going, you know, I'd have to take vanilla, and vanilla in, you know, it wouldn't maybe be straight vanilla, it might be vanilla mascarpone or vanilla marsala, but I'd need some kind of vanilla flavour, and that would be the biggest seller. And now that's slowly changed, and now it's the complete opposite, whereas on Saturday, vanilla was the slowest to go, and everybody was, you know, was getting involved with the new flavours and with the things that were more adventurous. So I'd say, yes, that used to be the case where I'd have to bring the same things. There were staples I'd have to have, but now, no, not at all.
How do you find your inspiration?
It's just life, you know, it just comes from everywhere, whether it's, you know, trying a cocktail that I'd not had before, or seeing what other people are doing, being in a restaurant or being in another place and seeing different combinations, and, you know, they spark off other thoughts, and talking with, you know, other cooks and other chefs, and, you know, it comes from everywhere.
And you've got an allotment, of course, so you get things from there still, or at least that does that inspire you a bit?
It does, yeah. Although, you know, there's all kinds of things that I want to grow that I haven't grown.
Have you ever done a tomato ice cream?
I did as a special request for a May ball, I did a Bloody Mary sorbet.
Okay.
So that was obviously heavily tomato based, which is quite nice.
Yeah, interesting. I would imagine that a tomato ice cream might be nice.
Do you think you could get the flavour out of the leaves somehow? You know, like you do blackcurrant leaf and peach leaf. I've never tasted one, but the smell, I think, is just
that's
the best
very
thing
interesting.
Ever.
That's but very might interesting. Be quite it might be deadly.
Stringent, or might be poisonous as well.
Because they're from the deadly nightshade family, aren't they? Tomatoes. And what has been your most popular flavour this year, Jack?
That would be a close call between strawberries and cream and Earl Grey and plum sorbet.
Mmm, gosh, that sounds good. Extra virgin olive oil is one of my favourites. Are you still making that?
Still making extra virgin olive oil. I did a couple of variations, did extra virgin olive oil base and then with some candied orange peel and some pine nuts, and that was quite delicious.
Oh my goodness.
And one again with some smoked sea salt crystals and olive oil base. Mm.
So you're now at Nord.
I have a counter at Nord, yes, which, so that's different to my, that's not somewhere that I supply like the Gog Magogs or Urban Larder. That's I rent that space from them, and I run it in, you know, independently, and I staff it and have full control over it, which is nice. And then, you know, there's 10 flavours. There's exciting things going on there. I'm really happy about what we did there.
And do you think there's room in Cambridge for Jack's Gelato Ice Cream Parlour?
I hope so.
I think there definitely is. I'm sure some of the listeners do too. And do you find, obviously it slows down quite a lot in autumn, winter. So do you spend that time developing ideas? Will the Nord still be having ice cream?
I operate the business 12 months of the year. So I supply places 12 months a year. So Cherry Hill Chocolates in Ely, who I supply, they keep their ice cream counter going 12 months of the year. And obviously restaurants such as Pint Shop, they keep it going in December. That's probably the month in which they have the most ice cream.
Wow.
It goes crazy. And I do little pots for the junctions, Christmas shows. And so there's lots of ice cream production going on through the winter. And I do home deliveries. And there's all kinds of things. But yes, it is a quieter time. So that's when I work on new flavours throughout the year, just as ideas come to me, but lots of them I kind of have to write down and put on hold and wait until the autumn and the winter, and I'll have a play around with them. And then I do all the other peripheral stuff, such as, you know, accounts and admin and reconfiguring the unit and building new boxes for the bike and all manner of things.
And how many bikes have you got now?
I have 3 bikes. I very rarely have one bike out at a time. It's just for occasionally you get, it's strange in something that you get these weekends in which everyone wants to book you, and then the next weekend is not so busy. So yeah, I have 3 bikes to try and be able to meet that demand
And do you ever have time just to do as you did, were doing to begin with, putting a bike out somewhere you're allowed to and scooping?
Yes, outside the Botanical Gardens on the Brookside Gate. I'm there Saturday and Sundays, weather permitting.
Excellent. Good place for people to go and find you. So you've got this lovely unit now. Does that help you to think where, what other sort of strands? Because you said your business is kind of in strands. Are there other strands you could add? Have you got thoughts about your future? And
with the unit, certainly. I mean, I share with Steak and Honour, so we obviously provide each other with inspiration and motivation. You know, we did one event for Eat Cambridge where we threw the doors open and invited people here, and that was lovely. And I think that's something we both want to do again and to do more of. We're just trying to find the time.
And you did pizzas that day, Jack. Is that another strand that you're thinking about?
It is. It got slowed down by the fact that my oven got stolen the next day. But a new oven will be coming at some point. I love a good wood-fired pizza. Good wood-fired pizza.
And what are you going to do with your horse box, Jack? Or two horse boxes? What's the plan? What was the plan?
The plan was, I forget the original plan. It was either to have it as to put a wood-fired oven in there, or just to have it as a little mobile gelateria.
So the empire of Jack's Gelato is going to grow, I can tell. And I think we should watch this space for sure. Thank you, Jack. And good luck with the rest of the summer.
Wood-fired pizzas are something Thank Jack you, did Rose. When he ran Cotto in East Road. I don't know how many people remember that. I've had one pizza in my life which I thought was any good, so it will be nice to try one of his if it happens. I was away when he did them at Eat Cambridge.
Yes, and Jack's Gelateria would be pretty good too, I think.
Yeah, it would, wouldn't it? I'm not sure from the interview that that's as likely somehow, but let's hope.
Published just last week, the new Cambridgeshire Cookbook features all of our favourite independents, including Jack's Gelato, a Romy pint shop, and everything in between. Cambridge Food Tour's Herla de Boer helped compile the book, so I asked her a bit more about it.
With Herla de Boer, who runs Cambridge Food Tours, and she's also been heavily involved with the Cambridgeshire Cookbook, which has just come out.
Well, yeah. It's just come out last week.
Right.
Yes, last Friday.
Right, so tell us a bit about it.
Well, it's very exciting. I was approached by Lisa from Metzer Publishing in Sheffield. And they've already published a cookery book in Sheffield. And they were so successful that they decided to publish more books. And one of them is the Cambridgeshire Cookery Book. We've worked on this for a few months. It's a really good selection of independents, from Michelin-star restaurants to cafes to restaurants outside Cambridge. Very, very good.
How did you compile all of this?
Lisa did most of the work, and I sort of gave a few suggestions who she could approach, but Lisa Pullen is it's her brainchild, actually. And she's originally from Cambridge, so, yes, she's very, very pleased about it.
What made you want to be involved with the book?
Well, because we run the food tours and we include independents on our tours, and I think it's a great thing because this Cambridge needed something like this to showcase what we've got. A lot of people think that Cambridge is only the colleges, but I'm very pleased that one of the colleges is in there as well. So, yes, I really want to be involved and assist and push it. And some really good recipes in there. But it's not just the recipes. It's great to have it on your table and check where you want to go next for dinner or to shop. It's a really good guide. It's a Bible of Cambridgeshire, where to eat and shop.
Any favourite recipes in here?
I must admit, I haven't gone through it in detail yet because I've been very busy. But I did spot the cured salmon of Clare College, and I'm quite keen to try that one out. This is not the first Cambridge cookery book, actually. Many years ago, Karen Billows, she published a Cambridge cookery book. And these are recipes from all the colleges from East Anglia. Very interesting to read as well, completely different to this. And they're very old-fashioned recipes, like grassy pudding. But the cookery book, the Cambridge cookbook, is all about present, of course, with all the very good chefs in there, the local shops, and one in particular I'm very pleased is in there is Adelia from Norfolk Street Bakery, because she makes amazing pasta annata. She didn't share the recipe in this book because it's her secret recipe. And, of course, we're in there as well, so you can get a taste to see what our food tours are like. Not just a book with recipe, the images are stunning as well. Anybody who comes to Cambridge, visits Cambridge, it's a very nice memory to take home. You can buy it on Amazon as well and in Waterstones at all the independent shops who are part of it. If you don't want to go to the shop, you can order online via our website as well.
What do you like most about the book?
Oh, it's a good showcase of Cambridge. Cambridge and Cambridge, it's fantastic. I think it's really, really good. And we sort of rave about Cambridge on our food tours, but it's great that there's now a book which tells how great Cambridge and Cambridge is.
Great, well, thank you very much.
Yes,
Ella.
Thank you very much.
Make sure to pick it up. You can find it at any of the independents mentioned in the book, places like Afternoon Teas in King Street, Aromi in Peace Hill and Bennett Street, Cambridge Wine Merchants in Bridge Street, the Food Press in Prospect Row, as well as the Cambridge Food Tour website, and the list goes on and on. You'll have to look at the book to find out where you can get it. It's a really lovely book as well. I'm dying to try some of these recipes.
Yeah, we've got a copy in front of us, haven't we? And I mean, my first reaction was how beautifully produced it was.
Yeah.
And as you said, it's on good paper, it's got a nice font, lots of colour photographs. It's also, as well as the recipes, tells a bit about the story of each place, and they're all places that we know and love on flavour.
Yeah.
I'm really impressed.
I'm very excited. I hope lots of people pick it up, because when I travel, I like to look at stuff like this. So if you've got it on your table and think, oh, well, you know, where am I going to go eat in Cambridge? Well, it's basically the Cambridgeshire Bible of food.
It is. Recommended.
Yes.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Now, a newcomer that we featured a few programmes ago is Provenance Kitchen. Food blogger Pina Broccoli Anaya went to Burwash Manor last Saturday to try it out. Their food is prepared with care and originality. So listen now to co-founder Mark Hughes explaining the method of cooking pulled pork, for example.
Basically, because we're at Burwash, we're using their produce. So from the land, we got in touch with Tyler, who's got the field at the end of Burwash.
Of Dynamic Organics.
Yeah, you got it, yeah. And so we asked him what he has at the moment, and he has fantastic spring onions, rainbow chard. So what we're doing, the spring onions, a lovely way to cook them, is like calçots from Catalonia.
Yeah.
But obviously they're indigenous to Catalonia. They're sort of bigger than a spring onion, more like a baby leek. And you just roast them so they're all charred and they go very, very sweet. And you dip them in Romesco sauce. And so that's that was inspiration for that one today, using all the local produce.
For those who are not familiar with Romesco sauce, can you just give us a brief description
of
what it is?
Well, it depends how you want to do it, but the main ingredients are will be hazelnuts, paprika, sweet or slightly spicy paprika, olive oil. I say there's hazelnuts, there can be other types of nuts in there. It's actually a bit open how you want to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the traditional recipes in Catalonia, but you just change it. But what gives it the body, not everyone does, is bread. You have to put stale bread in. And the olive oil then turns it into an emulsion.
Excellent. So your next one is from the sea, which I've tried it at your launch, the hay smoked sea trout, and it's served with...
We've got the local new potatoes from Tyler, and we've got nasturtium leaves, which Tyler supplies with as well. And the thing about the sea trout is we smoke it in hay, which is a really effective way of imparting a great flavour. Well, you cure the whole side of fish first with salt and water, leave it in the fridge for a certain time, that pulls all the water out, and then we put the fish in the smoker, we put it skin side up, put the hay on top, and then we burn the hay. The skin protects the fish from the burnt hay, but the smoke goes round to the bottom, so the flavour goes up into the flesh. And then we'll peel the skin off, and that's got all the lovely flavour, but without actually burning the thing.
Well, it was really tasty when I had
good.
It. It was really good. So next we've got from the farm menu. We've got two things there.
Yeah, we actually have done our take on a pulled pork bun. But we're trying to make it less barbecue American style and more indigenous, I suppose. So we cook the Dingledale pork shoulder for 12 hours at 90 degrees. Oh, we actually smoke it first, then cook it.
So much patience.
Well, yeah, put it in the oven and walk away again. And watch the telly.
Yeah, I just want to eat it right away, but that's me.
And then we pull it apart, and then we'll put it back and add some stock that we've actually boiled the bones down from the pork. So it all comes together, there's lots of layers there. And then we put in a brioche bun, which we put into the wood-fired oven that we've got, so it crisps around the edges. We add that with a homemade bacon and fennel jam, and then just whatever pickles we happen to have at the time, whatever seasonal. We make some garden pickles, and we put it all together. The idea is to get the bun quite crispy, so it's soft in the middle and crispy on the outside. So it's just not like eating, if not, brioche can be a bit cakey, if not, I think.
Yeah, I did have that. That was my lunch today, and you're absolutely spot on about the bun. It wasn't cakey, it was nice and light, and I really liked all the sweet flavours.
Well, yeah,
from
and
the
I just like
you brought out.
There's so many people do pulled pork, and it's great, but we want to make it, like you say, more in keeping with what we do at the restaurant.
Yeah.
So we take layers when we make the pork. We don't just roast it, we smoke it, roast it, and melt the. Melt it back in with the bone stock and all that to try to give it a lot of flavour, hopefully.
It was really, really good.
Good, glad you like it. And then we've got the free-range brick chicken. What we basically do, we spatchcock the chickens, debone the whole thing, put a whole chicken on the plancha at the same time, and you do it very slow. We actually have brick chicken weights, irons that we put on the chicken.
So is that where the brick comes from?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But instead of using bricks, we use irons because they're kind of cool.
Yeah.
And also we didn't want to get a brick on our chickens.
Yeah.
You have to put them in silver foil normally.
Yeah.
So we actually weigh it down onto the chicken, and that's been marinated in some pimenton, sherry vinegar and garlic. And then once it's nice and crisp, we'll take it off, slice it through, put it back on with a final glaze of the sherry vinegar pimenton sauce. And then we serve that with flatbread, some bulgur wheat, chicken on top, and some romesco sauce.
Lovely, lovely.
Yeah, and chard, of course, yeah.
And then I really like how you include something from the dairy, which is a bit of a pudding, but nothing really very sweet, nice and fresh,
yeah,
fruity, creamy.
Yeah, the
Today
it's the gooseberries with the set vanilla cream, an elderflower jerry, and some honeycomb.
Yeah,
and
that was really good. I had that.
Oh, good. I'm
nice.
Glad you
good texture. Good texture.
Well, the idea is that obviously in Britain we're good at berries, and now's the season, especially strawberries. Raspberries are coming around now. We'll be using them, and gooseberries. So the idea, we don't like, obviously don't want it too sweet, but the honeycomb is very sweet, but that sets off against the tartness of the gooseberries. But the idea is to have something English that you don't normally see. I can't go anywhere and order gooseberries for my dessert. I don't know why you can't do that.
Yeah.
We have damsons, gooseberries, and we're not just trying to be indigenous. We'll use good food from anywhere. Like apricots at the moment are fantastic from Italy. And so if I was using apricots, I'd have to use them from Italy. But we've got great gooseberries, so we use them.
Yeah, so the trick is to just source the best products
get,
and it's also seasonal, so sounds like you put together a nice, fresh menu.
Well, we're not trying to be too clever. This whole thing with farm-to-table is all well and good, but you can't always do it, nor should you always do it in certain seasons. But if there's an abundance of produce next door to you, it kind of makes sense to use it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the only reason for doing it. It makes sense, and it almost tastes...
And everything you make, from what I've had at the launch and today... you know, it's just nicely put in like a cardboard box. You can eat it with the wooden forks and knives, and it's just a really like practical way to eat it. But like you're not sitting in a restaurant in a formal environment, but you're having like a really nice dish that you would get in a restaurant.
Well, the whole point to it's never going to be because you're eating out of a box, exactly as hot as it should be on the warmed plate. Kind of thing. The point is, it's informal. But really, I don't know many people nowadays who want to go and have a free course meal starter in the formal way anymore and spend 30 quid every night on dinner because they can't do it. Whereas actually with ours, it's affordable.
Yep,
you're getting
really
the same
value.
Quality food, and it's much less informal. But like I say, whenever I go out for dinner, I want to just eat some food. I don't want to have to eat it in a particular order.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the way that things are moving at the moment. I think that's pretty much on trend.
I do like that you have some homemade sodas. Today we have elderflower lemonade. When we were at the launch last week, there were some gin fizzes that were nice. Can you talk about some of those gin fizzes with elderflower?
Well, what it is as well, in the UK people love a cordial, but they never generally make them themselves. It's really easy to do. It's sugar, water, and the fruit, or whatever your infusion. So elderflower flowers. We do a great strawberry cream soda. Well, to make a cream soda, you're basically adding vanilla and some cream tartare. That's all it is.
It's nice that you have alcohol options as well for certain types of occasions.
We want to do that as much as we can.
Yeah.
But basically, if you're making a gin fizz. We got some great gin from Warner Edwards, and they've got elderflower infused gin and rhubarb infused gin. And rather than just adding the flavours afterwards, these are made distilled in copper pots as you're making real gin with the real botanicals. So they're actually very good quality, and they lend themselves beautifully to the elderflower and the rhubarb with the strawberry and the cream soda. So when we made the gin fizzes, what we did, we used the same base as the cordial, which would be, so if you make a gin fizz, you've got your citric component or fruit component, the sugar, the gin, you shake it, and then you add the soda to give it the fizz, and the sugar will be doing that. Well, we actually use the cordials with the gin, and you've already got the sugar element in there. And then what we added at the top, we gave it a fizz, but we actually made a lemon foam in the gas canister. You basically, it's one you use for cream. You put gelatine with water and lemon.
Ingenious.
A lot of people do it. And then you put the gas canister in, and that puts the CO2 in, and it makes it into a foam. So on top of the gin fizz, we gave a little piece of foam, and that will give you the sherbet-y hit that you should have in a really good gin fizz.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for walking us through the menu.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for letting us talk about it.
You can follow the whereabouts of Provenance Kitchen on their Twitter and Facebook. They have a brand new website, too, at provenancekitchen.com. For bookings and inquiries, they can be reached by email at ask@provenancekitchen.com. Good luck with this new venture, Mark. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks very much, Pina. It's a pleasure. Look forward to seeing you again.
And thanks to Pina for that feature. Her online blog is 1-2 Culinary Stew, by the way. It's interesting, very impressive sounding food over at Provenance Kitchen. And you can find them today at Burwash Manor. It's on the road going into Barton from the A603. They're there right now, and they'll be serving until 3 p.m. And remember, you can follow Flavour on Twitter to find out about where they and other vendors will be in and around Cambridge. Our Twitter handle is @Flavour105.
Well, hi everyone, this is Jackie Bond inviting you to join me every other Monday night at 7 o'clock here on Cambridge 105. The show is Let the Good Times Roll. We've got rock and roll, doo-wop, rhythm and blues, and even a little bit of rockabilly for all you cats out there. Yeah, this is the show that will blow away those Monday blues, get you jumping and a-jiving, so roll back the carpet and join me here. We'll Let the Good Times Roll on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Be there or be square, daddy-o.
And a couple of tweets that have come in since the programme started today. Jack's Gelato, new flavour combination of cardamom and rose, and that's debuting at the counter at Nord today. And today's takeout beers from Calverley's Brewery in Hooper Street. They're open till 4 o'clock this afternoon. Citra and Simcoe Pale Ale, and also their Five Hops beer. And finally, for now at any rate, the Cambridge Blue have tweeted to say that they have a barbecue tonight from 5 p.m.
Yum. A good way of finding out about great food and drink that's not on Twitter is to go on one of Herla de Boer's food tours, which she started doing 3 years ago. After we talked about the Cambridge Cookbook earlier, we went on to talk about the tours.
You started Cambridge Food Tours nearly 3 years ago now.
Yes, that's correct. Time flies. And not just me. 3 years ago, Adelia started on the same date. And I only found out when I run my first tour. So we always celebrate together. So it's now our third time. So we'll pop a bottle and we'll cheers in the next year. So it's really, really good. And things have really developed because I started to schedule food of one schedule food tour, the classic food tour. And at the moment when I started, there were a lot of interesting places, but not as many as now. So soon I realised I had to change it a bit, make a different and more reasonable food tour as well, which I did. And from that, we've moved on to private tours, a lot of stag parties, a lot of hen parties, a lot of corporate and food events, because people now come to me and they want to put something together. They don't know where they can find it, so and I'll assist, which is very interesting. So we've had some big names as well, so it's very, very interesting to work with them. So, yes, very pleased.
That's amazing. So how can you even keep up with all of the food scene?
Difficult. I've just come back from Bee's Kitchen today because they just opened the door, so I had something to eat there, which is really good. And tonight we'll sample a bit more. Yes, it's a lot of eating, a lot of eating required, and a lot of contact. So the way to connect with the locals is to be there to talk to them. When I see something's been redone, I'll stick my head through a door and find out what is happening and if something's closed down, what's happened. So, yes, it takes a lot of time, but I know a lot of people in Cambridge. It's a very small network, and it's good to see this scene growing so much.
That's brilliant.
Yes, so, yes, on the scheduled tours, I only can include a fixed number of places, but on private tours, it's great because I build them around the person who either celebrating or who's the company, what I want to focus on. So, Cambridge is my oyster. It's great. And, of course, I've got a few very good, of at least one good guy trained up now as well, and she is very good and very enthusiastic.
Where do you see it going after 3 years? Obviously, it's evolved so much already.
Yes, I don't know. I think what we can do is sort of, I'm trying to get somebody else on board as well, so we've got more guides, but the guides have to be good. They need to be foodies, and they need to understand the food scene. So it's difficult to sort of train somebody up, especially on Saturdays. We're probably going to run more tours, and we don't know, because it's developed over the last 3 years very quickly. Yeah. So we don't know where it's going.
Oh, that's exciting, though.
Yes, exactly.
Brilliant. Well, thank you again very much.
Thank you. Carla.
That excellent tour guide she mentions, well, it's yours truly. Her tours have really evolved, and as Cambridge evolves, so will the tours.
Yes, and one way in which Cambridge is evolving is in catering for specialised diets. We did a big feature on the wide range of gluten-free foods a while ago. You can still hear it in the podcast. But there is much more on offer for vegans too, as Matt discovered on a recent trip to the market.
Hi, we're Vegan Sweet Treats. My name is Evie Wilman, and with my daughter Laurel Wilman. We're at the Cambridge Sunday Market every week near the Guildhall, and we're offering vegan cookies and fudge, including healthy fudge.
Why did you choose vegan? I'm guessing there's a story behind that.
Yeah, I can tell the story.
Yeah?
Okay, when Laurel was 9, she decided to become a vegetarian, and she was vegetarian for a few years, and then she investigated more into animal welfare and became vegan. Veganism was because of the cruelty in farming today, particularly in the dairy industry. I actually find that worse than the meat industry. I think it's a lot tastier having vegan food. Gradually over time, she's developed recipes so she could still have her favourite treats, like chocolates. She's just invented lots of vegan products, including the fudge, which are really, really good, and a website and an online shop, and she started selling the products online, and then we thought the Cambridge Market would be a really good plan.
It just felt like the right place to do it because being a vegan here, there's not many options to eat in many places. So I wanted to provide vegans and vegetarians also with more choice. It's really important what it all tastes like. It has to taste good because we also want to sell to non-vegans and non-vegetarians as well because everyone can eat our products.
How about consistency? I was quite interested in this because whenever I've tried vegetarian alternatives to something, it doesn't quite chew right, it doesn't feel right or taste right. Do you get any critiques from people who try some of your vegetarian or your vegan stuff and say, this really, it tastes in the mouth like normal fudge?
I think people often can't tell the difference between our fudge. They often ask what's in it, and a lot of people don't realise that it's vegan. I think the vegan and vegetarian meats, I think non-vegetarians can definitely tell the difference with those, but they don't need them. The cookies,
I don't think you can tell the difference with the cookies
Normal.
We just replaced the egg with corn flour and the butter with margarine, and I don't think you can tell.
The chocolate's obviously different.
Yeah, the chocolate, yeah, that's vegan chocolate that we've made with soy protein powder. So, yeah, you can't tell. I don't think.
Okay, so we offer 5 different flavours. We make our own vegan chocolate, 10 fudges online. The flavours of the cookies are milk, white chocolate, triple chocolate, the fudge cookie, and dark chocolate. And they're £1.50 for a bag. Fudge is vanilla, caramel, lemon, chocolate orange, mint chocolate, peanut butter, chocolate swirl, white chocolate, fruit and nut, and we're now offering coconut.
They're in 90-gram bags of fudge, and they sell for £2.50.
You're creating these recipes yourself, right? I'd just like to really underline the fact that everything you see here, concoctions from yourself over the years.
Yeah, I develop the recipes using a base fudge recipe, and then I can change the flavours.
But with the mock meats as well, you developed those recipes yourself, didn't you?
Yeah. We make our mock meats with wheat gluten, so they're really high in protein. We add in different flowers and herbs and spices to give them the different flavours. And you can add in more liquids like soy sauce and oils to give different textures.
With the mock meats, you have made, you know, chicken nuggets and cocktail sausages and steaks and sausage rolls as well. And we alternate, we have different things on the market stall each week, which we're going to put on our website so people will know what's available each week because it will be different.
I was very interested when I was looking on your website how your healthy fudge was made, because I've tried making my own fudge and I know it's full of butter and sugar and syrup. And healthy fudge, how can fudge possibly be healthy?
Well, we've taken out the refined sugar and we've replaced that with agave syrup, which is a vegan substitute for honey and a natural alternative to sugar. And then we've put in peanut butter and soy protein powder to bulk it up a bit, so they're going to be high in protein. And we've got cocoa in there, which is healthy fats.
Yes. Yeah.
I was really drawn in by the agave syrup as well, because I didn't know that this existed. And when I looked it up, it's this massive, spiky, cactus-like South American plant.
Yeah, so it's boiled up until they get a syrup. It's not bad for you, like refined sugar. And so it's a really good alternative. And all of our healthy treats are all made with the agave syrup and xylitol.
Of course, the date bars don't have any agave syrup or xylitol in. They're made with dates and nuts mainly, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, and raisins. Good for you.
You must be very proud as a mum to be here supporting your daughter and her business and seeing it grow and seeing it become...
I am impressed, because it's just these inventing new things to eat, because I didn't have any idea what she could eat when she was younger. And so she has done it all herself. She's created lovely food. We just need to get out there and let people know we're here. But yeah, it's doing well.
We are Vegan Sweet Treats. You can find us online at vegansweettreats.org or every Sunday at the Cambridge Market, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
Okay.
You did really well. Thank you.
That was Evie and Laurel Willman. I tried some of their lemon fudge. It was softer than the regular fudge, I think. And at first, the first chunk I was put off because of the sweetness. Maybe I was expecting the lemon to be light. But when I went back, the flavour really hit me. It was addictive. And that was the bag gone. Now, lemon fudge will be indelibly linked forever in my mind with vegan sweet treats. And they will be there at the market once again, Sunday, 10 a.m. sharp.
Cambridge 105's proud to be out and about in the city. Do you have an event coming up and like us to be there? Email your details to publicity@cambridge105.fm. Cambridge 105, closer to our community.
Lots of people would like to grow their own fruit and veg, but often the months go by and the moment is lost. Those who have managed to get things in the ground will be harvesting now, some of them, and leaving bare soil. Now, at the end of July, can anything new be sown? Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments gave Alan some ideas when they met this week.
Dave, there's a lot of empty spaces appearing on allotments now as crops like broad beans finish. What can we do with them? Is it too late to sow any more seeds?
Well, certainly not, no. It's a great time of year because we're harvesting, so we're getting the benefit of our early work, but there's still plenty of time to get late summer and overwintering crops in.
Such as?
Well, I have several sort of, if you like, standard rotations. So after my first early potatoes, which there's a row here we're digging, I've dug another row completely already, I plant leeks. And that timing works for me because the potatoes come out by before, say, the end of June. And the soil's quite loose, so it's nice and easy to make a good deep hole to put your leek seedling in and water it in. And also with potatoes, inevitably one leaves a few in the ground, which grows weeds. But that's not going to trouble the leeks too much, so that's a good example. Another would be chicories and endives, very very fast growing because it's so warm, things will germinate almost immediately. But also turnip, radish, still not too late even for carrot.
Right, when would carrots be ready to eat?
October, September, late September, October, because they're going to grow fast.
Yeah.
Come in packets saying, you know, sow by the end of June. Well, okay, that was written and printed before our weather pattern started changing so radically. You know, we might have an Indian summer. We might not get a frost until December. Who knows? If you've got the spare land, give it a try. Get a crop in there, and even if it's only a 50% chance, you may well win.
Yeah.
We've seen how extraordinary the weather can be at the end of last week when certainly Trumpington got hit by a major thunderstorm with monster hailstones the size of pound coins, which have done astonishing damage to some of my plants. Here we have some squashes where the older, larger leaves have been shredded. There are many, many holes. The fruits, here's one. This is pockmarked with a deep pitted hole, and that's not slug damage. That's hailstones have done that. I've got quite a few of those.
That's extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. I mean, you know, you get hail in winter. Sometimes a bit of a hailstorm in spring, but of course at that time the plants are not in full growth and producing fruit, so we don't see damage like this. And this was a very severe storm. There's about 3 hours of it, and my tomatoes on the patio, they look like they've been machine gunned. The tops have come off many of the plants. The flowers have come off. A lot of the fruit that was already setting has come off. So I'm a bit pessimistic about my tomato crop this year now, unfortunately. But this is the exciting thing about gardening, I suppose.
The unpredictability of it, anyway.
Yes.
Okay, as far as tomatoes are concerned, too late to sow tomatoes?
Oh, yes, far too late.
Right.
And it's even really a little late to plant them out. If you're lucky enough to have a greenhouse or a polytunnel, then get them in. But, of course, sowing them certainly too late. If you can get some seedlings from someone else or even buy some from the garden centre, you could try it. I mean, who knows what's going to happen with our weather,
yes.
With the weather for the rest of 2015.
And what about if you've forgotten to put any sprouts in? Is it will sprout seedlings work?
Yes, they should do, definitely. Certainly not too late to put in any of the overwintering brassicas. They've still got time now to establish a good root system, get plenty of leaf growth, make a nice strong plant that's going to store its resources and survive the winter, and then give you a good crop of sprouts around Christmas or broccoli in the spring. We've got some over here, actually, and these went in a month or so ago, actually, but... what we're looking at here is, if I remember rightly, broccoli seedlings, and they've been a bit bashed by the hail, but they're going to be okay because they've got good strong roots and, as I say, plenty of time to grow new leaves. You'll notice this bed is quite weedy. That's intentional.
Right, and why is that?
Well, the problem with brassicas, certainly at this time of year, if you've got a green plant growing on a brown soil background, the pigeons find them very, very easily, and they love to eat the brassicas. So if you let the weeds grow around your brassicas, then the pigeons tend not to find them. That seems to be working here. That's a trick I learned off one of the older plot holders.
Yeah. So there's no danger of exhausting the soil by, as soon as one crop has finished, putting another one in?
Yes, sir. I think there is a danger of overcropping soil if you forget to feed it. I mean, it's always a great big circular process. This we've got to put back in at least as much as we take out.
You've mentioned green manure before. Is this a good time for green manure if you've got some bare patches?
It's a perfect time, and that's a great way to cover bare ground.
Right.
If you can't think of a crop, or you haven't got any seed, or you're sort of losing interest, and you want to have the rest of the summer off, putting in a green manure is a terrific way to cover the ground, to add some.
So green manure is a plant. Perhaps we better explain a little bit what it is.
So green manure is a plant which is grown for fertility rather than to eat directly. So one way or other, you're going to use it to feed the soil. So it's going to grow and produce organic matter, which will rot down, and you can either, when most of the growth is finished, and before it seeds, probably, you're going to cut it down. You can leave it on the surface to rot down there, where the earthworms will take it into the soil, and it will eventually become part of the humus, the organic matter within the soil structure. Or you could add it directly to your compost heap. The green manures have another function, which is that they cover the ground, and so they're going to prevent the leaching of nutrients in the soil by heavy rainfall. So that's a good thing. They also some produce very nice flowers. I grow a lot of Phacelia, which has a lovely lilac purpley flower, which the bees absolutely adore. And that's my favourite choice of green manure. It produces a lot of bulk and does not have a pernicious root.
Well, some green manures fix nitrogen, don't they? Mm. In other words, they convert the nitrogen in the air into nitrates in the soil, which plants need for growth. But not all of them do. Is there any point in using a green manure that doesn't fix nitrogen?
If you're planning to grow a crop of brassica, cabbage or something, in a particular piece of land, then growing a nitrogen-fixing green manure is a very good idea, because the brassicas are nitrogen-hungry. And so to follow... And you see that in the farmers' fields. They'll grow a great big field of field beans, and just as the field beans begin to flower, you're thinking, oh, that looks like a nice crop of broad beans there. It's not broad beans, it's field beans. They chop the whole lot down and plough them in. And then the nitrogen that's accumulating by bacterial action when the roots of the bean plant will break down and become available to the next crop, which is the brassicas. So they're going to do well. So it's a terrific natural way of improving the fertility of the soil. Here's another green manure, and this one's not a nitrogen fixer, but it has so many other fantastic properties that, having said experiment with the green manures, I would say everyone should grow this. This is Russian comfrey. It grows very quickly. So the characteristics of Russian comfrey are that it has a very deep tap root that goes down several feet, and it's a miner. It pulls up soluble nutrients from quite deep down. Right. So that's a very useful function, isn't it, when there's rain, especially on a well-drained soil like ours, when you've got nutrients that you've worked hard to put on or even spent money on, and then they get leached away below the level at which your regular crops are going to use them. The comfrey can get back down there, pull them back up, and accumulate those resources in the leaves. But the leaves themselves, they're a bit furry, they're quite thick, they're quite bulky, and one harvests it, well, better with a pair of shears, but here we can just rip them off with our fingers, and I make a nice pile of comfrey leaves, which can be used directly as a mulch or can go into the compost, or you can soak them in a large barrel of water and use the liquid feed, and that would be an excellent tomato feed for example, much better than paying money for expensive branded products in the garden centre. You can make your own. You do need quite a lot of comfrey plants to provide complete fertility for your garden. So it's a trade-off. You've got to go for it and dedicate the space to the comfrey. And it's a permanent crop. Let's not forget that, because it's got this deep root that is very difficult to get out. So when make sure you plant it in the right place.
Yeah.
It's quite difficult to move. That's a green manure, which is an accumulator of all sorts of nutrients.
Well, that does sound very useful.
Yeah, soluble salts like potash. I think I should probably, if I wanted to attempt complete closed fertility cycle in my garden, that is produce all the fertility on land, I probably would need to dedicate maybe 30 or a bit more percent of the land to something like, well, specifically to comfrey. And that would be quite a big commitment. I've probably got 10% under comfrey at the moment.
I suppose another virtue of green manure, if you dig it in or leave it to be pulled in by earthworms, is that it does add sort of better moisture retention, doesn't it? Breaks down to produce humus.
That's right, yeah. So humus-rich soil is going to retain moisture, and that's beneficial for anything that's trying to grow into it. And yes, just using it as a mulch is... here we are, here's some tomatoes, so I can just add this to the mulch that the tomatoes have already got, and that will break down and that will feed the tomatoes quite quickly. The comfrey leaves do break down, right. So, that nutrient will be available to this crop.
Sounds ideal.
That's quite a range of things you can still sow.
Yes, and even then we didn't mention everything by any means. I think most people know you can still sow things like lettuce, but may not know that you've got a good chance even with things like dwarf French beans, especially if you soak the seeds overnight before sowing them.
I think the big message is, unless it's a ridiculously long time after the recommended sowing date on the packet, give it a go. If the weather is mild, you'll probably get away with it. As Dave often says on these programmes, be brave, experiment. And what have you got to lose? A few seeds. Mm-hmm.
Now, you may remember the old playground arguments, debating with your friends about who actually introduced secondary fermentation in reinforced bottles. Was it the French or the English? Well, Alice Archer from the Cambridge Wine Merchants is here to enlighten us. With a pop and a fizz, here's a little bit about champagne.
Good evening. Can I get a bottle of chilled Bollinger Chardonnay and the Beluga caviar?
With everything?
Yes, with everything.
It's very important to distinguish champagne in its own right. In essence, this is a premium sparkling wine with a massively long and noble history produced solely in the Champagne region, which is just east of Paris. I was fortunate to be there just 2 weeks ago, and I'd like to share with you a few things that I learned and saw along the way. Since 1935, there have only been three major grape varieties allowed. This means that 70% of champagne production is made from red grapes. Three grapes are Chardonnay, 27%. So if you ever say you'll drink anything but Chardonnay, I'm afraid you shouldn't be drinking champagne. Pinot Noir is about 38% of production, and Pinot Meunier, which is slightly lesser variety, but it's a different form, a different mutation of the Pinot grape. So it provides sort of the back notes of the champagne. The Pinot Noir provides the body and finesse and the ageing ability, and then the Chardonnay really rounds it out with some lovely freshness. And it's this art of blending that is what makes champagne so special. The wine is made fizzy by what's known as a secondary fermentation in the bottle. Various complex sciences that go into this, but in essence, yeast and sugar are what make alcohol. And a secondary product of this is carbon dioxide. By enclosing this fermentation, this carbon dioxide is kept within the wine and forms what we know as bubbles. The finer the bubbles, the better the quality of the champagne. The reason that these grapes, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier and Chardonnay are used is because they're all early ripening. But also, the reason why champagne is sparkling, the reason why you will only very rarely find still wine from champagne, and that will usually be red, is that the still wines, frankly, aren't very nice. They haven't been ripened fully. So the wines you get are very high in acidity. The grape sugars haven't properly developed, which is why they're so good at then having a bit of sugar added, having a secondary fermentation, and really stepping the game up. Sparkling wines made anywhere where the grapes are too ripe will instantly be too sweet. They won't have that finesse. They won't have that crispness. They won't have that refreshing acidity. I will admit I was in champagne for a week, and if you drink champagne only for a week, it does hurt. I think I had acid burns on my tonsils. So don't drink only champagne for only a week, but it is a refreshing thing to know that it is top quality going into this. A few other little facts and figures. As I said earlier, 3/4 of champagne comes from red grapes. The way this is done is by squeezing very gently. I'm sure everyone's at some point either done this themselves, where you peel the skin off a red grape and inside the flesh is white. This is how white wine is made from red grapes, by crushing very, very, very gently. This also implies a lot of wastage. You're not getting the full amount of juice out of these grapes. You're only taking the very first press. It takes about 1.25 kilograms of grapes to make one bottle of champagne because of this wastage that goes on. This is a very important fact when you also look at some figures to do with champagne. Some vineyard plots in Champagne are selling for £1 million. 1 kilogram of grapes from a standard vineyard cost 4 to 6 euros, and that price is growing just for 1 kilo. So then you add another 0.25 onto that. Forget about Premier Crus, of which there are about 45, or Grand Crus, which there are 17. These are the best vineyards around. But just standard vineyards, 6 euros for a kilo of grapes. This means that It's about €7.50 just on the grapes, let alone on the ageing, on the manpower. If you see champagne for under £10, you know that they're not making any money from it. If you want to support the champagne industry, I'm afraid you shouldn't really buy £10 champagne. The champagne industry today produces about 322 million bottles, and it's worth over €4.5 billion. But how did champagne get to where it is today? Brief bit of history. Vines were first introduced in Roman times, as with much of France, and were developed by the church, largely, and monasteries were using it as a source of revenue, really. Originally, they were only making still wine, and this was being sent back and forth. There are many different arguments here as to who actually invented secondary fermentation within reinforced bottles. It is pretty much taken as fact that the English were actually the ones that designed these reinforced bottles, because the monk Dom Pérignon had witnessed when he'd capped a bottle and left a bit of extra yeast in there, bubbles forming in it. It likewise had happened when they'd shipped some casks of champagne to England, where they'd had a look at it, and yes, bubbles had started forming. But it was actually two Englishmen that developed these bottles, which is how the English can claim to have maybe invented champagne, because each bottle of champagne contains 6 atmospheres of pressure. So the early experiments with making these bubbles consistent and always there as you were drinking this bottle meant a lot of smash bottles. There are also rumours that sparkling wine production may have started elsewhere in France, but Dom Pérignon probably does have the right to the name. He was the pioneer who was out there experimenting. He was spotting that this could be an incredibly special drink, which it was. Since then, the word champagne's just become utterly synonymous with luxury and celebration. This is largely due to the French monarchy, actually, as from 898 to 1825, every king or queen of France was crowned in Reims, right in the heart of the Champagne region. Naturally, champagne wines were served during coronation and subsequent celebrations, not only in France, but then also in England, and it became as known as the nectar of monarchs. The wine Cristal, which became more famous recently by the rapper Jay-Z, both drinking it and then not drinking it, more famously. That wine was actually for Tsar Nicholas, I can't remember which one, I'm afraid, who thought it was absolutely sublime. The reason it's in a clear bottle is so that he could see that it actually was the champagne that he wanted it to be. And it also has a flat base, because no one could put a bomb underneath the bottle, which actually you could do with a normal bottle of champagne, because it's got that deep punt. Yes, the 20th century, it's really just flown. Champagne marketing has had a massive boom over the last 50, 60 years. The First World War was a very bad time for champagne. A number of houses were destroyed and the whole region really just ground to a standstill. But since then, marketing's really been on up through celebrities, through personalities, through films. James Bond is the one you'd instantly think of there with the wonderful Bollinger. And actually, it's quite funny, when I was at Bollinger, it's covered in James Bond posters. Not in all the very luxurious rooms, not in Lily Bollinger's drawing room or dining room, but in the workshops, in the winery, there are just James Bond posters floating around with Bollinger sprawled across them, which I thought was quite nice that they're taking this as well. In songs, Champagne Supernova. I'm not entirely sure which champagne that's actually referencing, but how many special people change? Winston Churchill wrote about it in his memoirs and has since then had a champagne named after him, which is the Prestige Cuvée from Paul Roger, which I think that's quite a claim to fame. I think if you can get to have a champagne named after you, I'll know I've been successful.
May I call you tomorrow, Countess?
I'm a night person. I've champagne and oysters in the fridge. Why not come in for a bite?
I always take a glass in the morning. You should try it. It adds a sparkle to the day.
That was Alice Archer, wine advisor for the Cambridge Wine Merchants. Shaken, but not stirred.
A On to the Cambridge food and drink news now. Just to repeat an item we told you about earlier, Provenance Kitchen are serving right now at Burwash Manor, and they will be there until 3 p.m. today.
If you're still feeling a bit peckish after that, then head over to The Geographers in Impington, where Steak and Honour will be serving until 4 p.m.
And this evening, you could round it off by going to the Six Bells in Covent Garden off Mill Road, where dough and pasta have an evening of Venetian food. That's food from Venice, not Venus. Three courses for a very reasonable £18, but you'll need to book. Phone Cambridge 355 559.
On Monday and Tuesday next week, Curly Kale Cafe will be popping up at The Architect in Castle Hill. They haven't popped up in quite a while, so best to reserve a table. You can just email curlykalecafe@gmail.com.
Starting next Saturday and every Saturday in August, Food Park will be at the Blue Moon in Norfolk Street from 12 till 4 p.m. That's great news. And it's also about 3 minute walks away from the studio, so we will see you there.
We will. Also popping up soon is Inda of Inda's Kitchen. She'll be the chef for the next CAM events night at Sticky Beaks Cafe in Hobson Street. It's on the 21st of August and will be a four-course meal, an Indian thali with three matched wines, fizz and tapas on arrival. The cost is £37.50. Tickets are available from Eventbrite and it's called Inda's Thali and Wines Pop-Up.
The next Mill Road Feast will take place on the 6th of September. And if you would like to set up a pitch, you can contact the Mill Road coordinator, who you can find and contact on Twitter.
Corpus Christi College in Trumpington Street has a dining event on the 11th of September. It's a three-course dinner, beginning with a drinks reception on the Old Court lawn, and the meal is followed by tea or coffee and petit fours. Phone 761 539 for more details and to book.
And finally, if you prefer just to look at food, you'll be delighted to know that the Great British Bake Off returns to a TV near you on the 5th of August.
Great.
And that's about the end of this edition of Flavour. You can enjoy us all over again, if you like, by listening to a repeat tomorrow at 7 a.m. or our podcast, which should be available by next Tuesday at the latest. So you can find that on the Cambridge 105 website, where the podcasts of all of our previous editions can also be found.
Remember that you can keep in touch with Cambridge food and drink news by following Flavour on Twitter. At Flavour105.
Coming up next is Bookmark. Presenter Lee Chambers chats with spoken word artist Holly McNish. Political thriller writer Misha Hiller about his new book, Disengaged, and Robin Stevens, author of The Wells and Wong Mysteries for Children. From 2 p.m, we've 3 hours of the summer Saturday programme. It's the show that goes out and about in Cambridge, broadcasting from the key events and goings-on. At 5, Radio Dante, the programme for Italians in Cambridge. Today's episode features two young Italian writers from Rome. And then, at 6 p.m, Jason Allen returns to pick more choice cuts from the 80s and 90s.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed the programme. You can catch us again in 2 weeks' time on Saturday, the 8th of August. We hope you can join us then. So for now, it's goodbye from Flavour.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.